Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, the cover story from this week's print edition of the New Times. He was at January 6th. The Phoenix Police Department hired him anyway. The story was written by Yana Kunichoff and Sam Stecklow and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on January 6th. In the sweltering summer of 2022, the Phoenix Police Department was almost a year into a Department of Justice civil rights investigation when it found itself facing a different kind of crisis, staffing. About 20 officers were leaving the department every month, said senior police officials, and recruitment was lagging woefully. The Phoenix City Council swiftly passed an ordinance that boosted new recruits' pay by $20,000 a year, making Phoenix police officers the highest-paid cops in Arizona. Soon, Scotty Bach joined Phoenix Police as a civilian investigator. Within 5 months, he became a Phoenix police officer. His swift rise owed in part to deep experience. Roughly 9 out of 10 cops the department hired in 2023 had been new recruits, but Bach came to Phoenix with more than 20 years of policing experience in Seattle. That seemingly made him eligible for a hiring bonus of $7,500. Since he wasn't a fresh recruit, the department had to spend money to train. Because his hire as an officer came after his initial civilian hire, Phoenix police officials later determined he was not eligible for the hiring bonus, the city said in a statement. Yet, like many veteran officers hired into short-staffed police departments, he also brought an unsavory past. Bach is one of 6 Seattle police officers whom the Seattle Police Department investigated for their presence at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Seattle's Office of Police Accountability confirmed that Bach was present at the Capitol, but investigators found inconclusive evidence of misconduct and did not sustain any disciplinary charges against him. Bach left the department after the investigation was concluded. Bach's hiring in Phoenix offers a caveat about the aggressive drive to fill vacant positions, especially in a city where police routinely abuse their power in the streets. Betrayal of the taxpayers. In May, the Trump administration dismissed the damning DOJ report that cataloged a pattern of practice and abusive behavior by Phoenix police. The cynical disavowal of the DOJ's findings came months before the department hired a new police chief, Matt Giordano, who until recently was the executive director of the Arizona Police Officers Standards and Training Board, or ASPOST. Under pressure, the department is trying to distance itself from its recent past. All the more reason to consider the pedigree of its newest veteran officers. Georgetown University law professor Vita Johnson, who has written about far-right extremism in policing on January 6th, told Invisible Institute, The Appeal, and Phoenix New Times that by attending an event that challenged the presidential election results, officers undermined their ability to serve in law enforcement, even if they were not charged with wrongdoing. That's a big betrayal of the taxpayers in my mind, and it really undermines community safety in a myriad ways, said Johnson. Johnson said it's still an issue if someone traveled across the continent to attend Trump's Save America rally without participating in the insurrection. She said attendees fell into two camps, those who believed the election was stolen and those who supported Trump's efforts to overturn the results, even though they understood he had actually lost. Either way, this is not something you would want in law enforcement, Johnson said. Those in the first category are likely prone to conspiracy theories, while those in the second don't care about the rule of law or our American institutions that are centered around the idea of liberal democracy. Other First Amendment experts have disagreed about the implications of attending the January 6th rally by police officers. In a statement, the Phoenix Police Department said Bach passed an extensive and complete background investigation. After more than a year of waiting, Invisible Institute, The Appeal, and New Times received public documents from Phoenix Police related to Bach. The department provided a heavily redacted 649-page file that briefly mentions investigators being aware of Bach's presence at January 6th, but otherwise does not show them reconciling that fact with their hiring standards. Bach's transfer from Seattle to Phoenix was approved not only by Phoenix background investigators, but also by officials with ASPOST, who audit the paperwork before it can be finalized. We have to approve a new hire audit before an officer's appointment can be finalized, Giordano wrote in an email in his previous capacity as ASPOST executive director. If we identify an issue, we send it back to the agency for them to address. Some agencies use a web-based platform and grant us access for the individual's file to review for our audit, while others provide us a hard copy HR file for our review. Either way, we do not remain in possession of the material after our review. The statement shared by Phoenix Police included the finding that after 20 years with the Seattle Police Department, Bach had retired in good standing. Yet, it's clear that Bach prefers the public not know about his extracurriculars. In 2021, after a Seattle University law student and others filed a records request, he and five other officers who were facing January 6th investigations sued to prevent their names from being publicly released. This, despite the fact that Divest SPD, an activist group that helps maintain a public database of complaints against Seattle officers, had already identified him and other officers by comparing publicly available data sets. Of those six officers who were investigated, two were publicly named when Seattle police leadership fired them for trespassing into restricted areas during the January 6th insurrection attempt. In February of 2025, the Washington Supreme Court ruled that the rest of the officers had attended a highly publicized and public event, and thus could not expect to remain anonymous. Their names were officially released in July, after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected their appeal. Be wary. During the Great Recession, cities around the country struggled to hire and retain police. Phoenix was even more austere than most. In 2008, the city instituted a hiring freeze that lasted until 2015. Over the years, as veteran police officers retired with no one to replace them, the department's roster shrank. Around the country, these dynamics increased the pressure on departments to recruit and hire new officers, and fast. I didn't see anything that looked quite as stark as Phoenix in terms of recession-era police hiring freezes, said Ben Grunewald, a Duke University law professor and criminologist who studies police misconduct and employment trends. Grunewald has also analyzed data from ASPOST. It's basically zero hires from 2009 to 2014, he said. In 2015, the city began a hiring spree. Since then, City Hall and Phoenix Police have worked to eliminate a deficit of around 600 officers they say are needed on Phoenix's streets. To do that, they've drawn from a pool of officers in other cities who, whether running from misconduct investigations in their old agencies or for more benign reasons, are looking for a change. Initially, the department expressed concerns about so-called lateral transfers from other departments. In 2017, the lieutenant who led recruitment efforts told the Arizona Republic, "We've learned that lateral moves are very strong indicators we should be looking very closely at," he continued. "We barely manage to hire two a month. We just cannot survive them coming here and making mistakes." In 2021, the city intensified its recruiting efforts. It rolled out raises across the board and added hiring bonuses of up to $7,500 for lateral transfers from other departments. In 2022, the City Council approved the same amount in retention bonuses for existing officers and created new positions for civilian investigators. At the time, Phoenix hiring data showed that the department rejected the vast majority of lateral applications, as many as 95% in 2021. Then Assistant Chief Brian Chapman told the City Council's Public Safety Subcommittee that this was because they failed to meet Phoenix's hiring standards. During the background investigation process, some applicants may tell us things that their previous employer is not aware of, and or we're not comfortable with bringing them forward, he told council members. This stance is in line with best practices promoted by organizations such as the Police Executive Research Forum, PERF, which cautions that departments should be careful when offering new recruits steep bonuses or big pay bumps. Agencies also have only a limited ability to learn about any misconduct an officer may have committed at a prior agency, PERF warned in an August 2023 report on the police staffing crisis. It cautioned agencies to be wary of lateral recruitment. Screaming for new officers. Just 3 months after the Phoenix City Council approved the new raises and bonuses, Phoenix's Human Resources Department presented a new plan to offer even higher raises to police officers during a remote meeting of the Human Resources Committee. The committee was, or rather the meeting, was not recorded or attended by any member of the public. According to the minutes, the committee approved the proposal after 8 minutes of discussion. The next week, the City Council considered the plan during a public hearing. Over objections of some residents who questioned new raises for police under federal investigation, the council voted 8-1 to approve the raises, which cost the city nearly $20 million. Phoenix police were now the highest paid in the state. Within months, department officials reported improvements to the City Council, including the hiring of more officers from out of state. We have seen a significant increase based on the market adjustment that was approved by the council to make Phoenix police officers the highest paid officers in the state of Arizona, Chapman told the Public Safety Subcommittee in September of 2022. We continue to see increased attention and inquiries not only from in the state of Arizona, but across the country. By March 2023, Chapman was telling the subcommittee that he was hoping to recruit 40 to 50 lateral officers from other agencies per year. The following months, after secret contract negotiations, brought a third raise for Phoenix officers in as many years. In October 2023, Commander Sarah Garza, a recruitment lead for the police department, reported that hiring exceeded attrition for the first time in several years. She credited the successive pay raises. Reporters obtained data on officer certification in Arizona that showed Phoenix police hired Bach as a lateral officer. That data was obtained through the work of the National Police Index, a project of Invisible Institute, Human Rights Data Analysis Group, and Innocence and Justice Louisiana, that tracks officer employment history. Experts warn that these incentives provide openings for officers with histories of misconduct to cross jurisdictions, fueling a hiring environment that overlooks dangerous or even criminal past behaviors. Every agency is screaming for more police officer applicants, and so that makes hiring and the acceptance of officers who may have questionable backgrounds a problem for us, said Patrick Solar, a former police chief in Illinois and a criminal justice professor at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. A program of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis illustrates the issue. In 2021, Florida used four-figure hiring bonuses to lure officers who felt mistreated by reform policies in New York, Chicago, and departments on the West Coast. As a result, Florida departments hired officers who have been arrested and charged with murder and kidnapping, or were hit with complaints for excessive force, false imprisonment, and sexual extortion. In Memphis, the police department spent millions of dollars on recruitment bonuses, and it requested dozens of waivers from the state to hire officers who would not otherwise meet hiring standards. In January 2023, five Memphis officers beat Tyree Nichols to death during a traffic stop. All five had been hired under reduced standards as part of the department's hiring push, including one accused of brutality and other misconduct in his past job at a Shelby County Correctional Facility in Tennessee. As a business decision, hiring former officers can offer benefits for any police department. The late Dorothy Moses Schultz, a former police captain and professor emerita at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, wrote in a 2022 report published by the conservative Manhattan Institute. But these departments must consider the possibility that they are attracting officers who are running away from problems. "I'm concerned about these incentives overall," she said in a 2023 interview. "You're recruiting from the same pool. This one's offering $5,000. This one's offering $7,000. But these smack to me of desperation. And I think it's very sad that we've come to a point where police have to be desperate to recruit." As of March 2025, there were still 600 positions that the Phoenix Police Department was looking to fill. 3 weeks after the DOJ report's release, Phoenix Police said they weren't planning on making any changes to their recruitment strategy, including the four-figure bonuses. "We're going to stay the course," Commander William Ju told Arizona's Family. "We believe our processes are tried and true and proven. We're going to continue to do the work we're doing, so we don't plan on changing that." Here's a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on January 8th. Phoenix activists hold vigil for Minneapolis woman killed by ICE. It was uncommonly rainy and cool Wednesday evening when more than 120 people packed a strip of sidewalk along Central Avenue in Midtown Phoenix. For months, that spot, right outside the field office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has been a common protest site to push back against the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda. Beyond the moisture, the air felt different on Wednesday night, 8 hours earlier, and at more than 1,600 miles northeast in Minneapolis, an ICE agent shot and killed a U.S. citizen in her car in the middle of a snowy residential street. Renee Nicole Good's killing was captured on video, sparking outrage across the country. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem blamed Good for her own death, claiming that the agent fired defensive shots after she attempted to ram the agent with her car. Video captured by bystanders tells a different story, showing that Good was steering away from the agent when he fired three times, hitting her at least once in the face. Jacob Frey, the mayor of Minneapolis, called Noem's self-defense claim bullshit. The pack of people who gathered outside the Phoenix field office on Wednesday said basically the same thing. The tightly packed group, led by several of Arizona's top immigration activist organizations, crowded the sidewalk in Phoenix to pay their respects to Good and call for action. Longtime immigration activist Raquel Turan outlined three demands: that a full and detailed investigation be conducted, all officers involved be brought to justice, and ICE get out of our states now, she said into a microphone to the event. She was a mother. She was a daughter. She was a neighbor. She was a friend to the people of Minneapolis, Turan said. We are with the Minneapolis community. Attendees bundled up in jackets, raincoats, and hats held lit thin white candles while others held small tea lights or protest signs attached to yardsticks. Signs read, "From Phoenix to Minneapolis, stop ICE terror." ICE out of Phoenix on the Suns logo. Or simply, fuck ICE. The crowd was packed with elected officials, including State Representative Lorena Austin, Phoenix City Council member Anna Hernandez, and State Senator Catherine Miranda, and local school board members Signa Oliver and Ed Hermes. It was also a who's who of local immigration and progressive activists, including Sal Reza, Common Defenses, Ricardo Reyes, Kai Newark, and Borderland Initiative's Beth Strano, among others. Melissa Hager, a 33-year-old from Levine, came out to the vigil with her husband, Brian, after watching the brutal video of Good Slang. She was at her office on Wednesday afternoon when a co-worker told her that ICE shot a woman in the face, Hager recalled. "We've been so desensitized. I was like 3 minutes before a call, and I was like, holy shit. And then I was like, I got to get on this call." Hager continued with her workday and didn't watch the video until later, but when she did, she quickly texted her husband. "I felt rage," she told Phoenix New Times. "What kind of world are we living in where this is happening? Where it is happening in broad daylight? It was just unbelievable." The couple decided to attend the vigil as a way to cope with the community, rather than staying inside and scrolling through social media and watching the news on the couch. "What's next is the fascist playbook? Because it's really scary," Hager said. "We're not accepting it. This is not the world that I'm creating." The news of Good's death comes as organizers, elected officials, and the immigrant community are gearing up for an influx of immigration activity in Phoenix amid reports that ICE will be targeting the metro area for enforcement and detention activity. Chants of "ICE out of Phoenix" echoed toward the ICE facility behind the group. "I want to send a clear message to Trump and his fascist goons," Phoenix City Council member Anna Hernandez said during the vigil. "Fuck ICE. Stay the fuck out of Phoenix. You are not welcome here." Another vigil for Good will be held at the ICE field office on Thursday at 6:30 p.m. The whole thing was a lie. The QAnon shaman looks back on January 6th. This story was written by TJ LeHeroux and was posted on January 6th. 5 years after his horned warrior attire and tattooed likeness became one of the most infamous images of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, Phoenix resident Jacob Chansley was at home eating organic gummy bears. "Forgive me, I have a mouthful. I haven't eaten very much all day," he told Phoenix New Times on a call Tuesday evening. Not the best thing to chew on the phone. President Donald Trump's administration has attempted to promote an Orwellian revisionist history of what happened on January 6th, 2021, falsely blaming Democrats for staging an insurrection that he egged on. One would think Chansley would be on board with that version of events. Trump gave him a pardon for storming the Capitol, after all. But he's turned sharply against the president recently. Known as the QAnon shaman, Chansley was sentenced to 3.5 years of prison time after entering the Capitol. He was released after about 18 months and later pardoned, tweeting that he'd go buy some guns. He announced a run for Congress as a libertarian in the Northwest Valley, though he never did get the work to gather signatures to appear on the ballot. More recently, he claimed to be the rightful president of America and sued that motherfucker Trump, along with a dozen entities, including the Federal Reserve, the National Security Agency, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Bank of International Settlements, the State of Israel, and T-Mobile for $40 trillion. The lawsuit is still pending. Chansley told New Times that he traveled to Washington, D.C. to serve the many defendants in this case, but he didn't get far, After arriving at his first stop, the Embassy of Israel, Chansley was immediately arrested. The guy looks at me and I go, "Hey, are you going to take this paperwork?" And they close the gate and walk away, Chansley said. And I was like, "What the fuck? Weird." So I'm just sitting there waiting and waiting. I'm like, "All right, screw this." So I walk up and I push the paperwork through a slot in the fence and then walk away. And then they called Secret Service, and then Secret Service came, and that was that. Chansley stayed the night in a D.C. jail that he said substituted steel plates stacked on top of each other for mattresses and was infested with cockroaches everywhere, like crawling all over the bed, crawling all over you. He said when he was released, he had to travel without a phone or any money for 4 miles to collect his property. His rental car was towed to Baltimore, which cost him $250 to retrieve, and he was charged extra for keeping the vehicle longer than agreed. He also missed his flight home and said his mother had to forward him money. He said he wasn't able to serve any other entities in the lawsuit and now has to return to D.C. for a court date in the coming months. "Logistical nightmare, bro," he said. Nobody responded to the summons, which I was kind of expecting that, but I didn't really have the financial backing to send out a bunch of certified mail the way I wanted to, especially after what happened to me in D.C. That fucking drained my account. Chansley said that a judge told him that if there aren't any developments soon, the case will be shut down. If that happens, Chansley said, I'm just going to do another one. In addition to providing updates on his lawsuit, Chansley agreed to speak with New Times about January 6th. For his part, Chansley doesn't believe Republicans or Democrats are to blame, but rather that events were orchestrated by a bipartisan deep state that has controlled the American body politic for decades. This conversation has been lightly edited for clarity and length. Have you spent much of today thinking about January 6th and those events 5 years ago? My mind is so spread out on such a broad scale that I don't just think about, you know, I don't think just about January 6th. I think about, like, how did we get here now? How did we get to a place where we could have something like January 6th and everybody not know that it didn't matter whether it was Trump or Biden? Some people don't understand. There was no difference between Trump and Biden in the whole thing that was a fucking ruse, bro. The whole thing was a lie. Can you explain more? We could talk about the fact that there's supposedly a bunch of images and footage of FBI dressed as Trump supporters already in the Capitol prior to the breach, and that's why they don't want to release the footage. They've talked about releasing the footage. They've never really released all of it. Editor's note, this claim has been widely debunked. We could talk about the pipe bomber, you know, and that whole situation and how I think ultimately, whether it be the riot or it be the pipe bomber, one or the other, the whole idea was to disrupt the election, to disrupt the electoral process or the electoral college. And if there was no riot, if that didn't work out the way they had hoped, then they would just use the excuse of the pipe bomb. I'm going to share this with you. It's pretty bizarre. So on December 21st, 2012, I was standing on my roof at like 6:37 a.m. watching the sunrise, tripping on mescaline, and I had this vision of the future where I was in downtown Phoenix with these tattoos, and I got this face paint on. I got my horns. I got my staff in my hand. I got like thousands of people behind me in the streets of Phoenix. And then in front of all of us, it looked like UN or like military type people with guns and helmets and police state kind of shit. And then I pound my staff into the ground, right? I do like a war cry. And then we all charge. And that was the vision. It was a bizarre vision. On January 6th, the image of me where I'm standing next to that guy as he's talking to the cop, and it looks like I'm, like, screaming, like it was that exact image from my fucking vision, except it was on January 6th and in Washington, D.C. What was your motivation for showing up in D.C. on January 6th? I've been targeted for a while, and that was part of my motivation for going, was just that. And you know, dude, if we don't do something, we're fucked. That's just all there is to it. And we can't keep going what we're doing. And we're not going to vote our way out of this. I had been singing down at the Arizona State Capitol and all over Arizona and the country. It's my religion, bro. I'm just practicing my religion. I was singing my shamanic song in that image that went viral. That close-up where it looks like I'm screaming, I was actually singing. I was climaxing my shamanic song. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any transportation. I didn't have any way of really getting there. I had like 500 bucks, dude. And so this is where it gets bizarre. And this is how I know the government is targeting me. Mike Pompeo's nephew, with a part of this group of people, helped me get to D.C. for January 6th. I didn't know he was Mike Pompeo's nephew at the time, but turns out he was. And that same dude, Mike Pompeo's nephew, went viral in an image from January 6th. He was right near the breach where they were handing the weapons inside the Capitol, and he never got arrested. It's interesting. Editor's note, there appears to be little factual basis for the claim about Mike Pompeo's nephew. When did you come to the conclusion that January 6th was a ruse? Well, when Trump refused to release the Epstein files, and then we didn't get the Doge cuts, and then we didn't get the Fort Knox audit, I think those three together, in combination with a number of other things that happened, were what did it for me. I was all the past year. It all happened so quickly. What was your opinion of what happened on January 6th while Biden was in office? Well, look at it like this, okay? Bill Clinton went to Epstein Island. He flew on Lolita Express 26 times, right? Now you got that painting that Jeffrey Epstein had of Bill Clinton in the red shoes and the purple dress, right? He's got Bill Clinton in his pocket, suffice to say. Same thing with Bush and the Jenga towers and the paper airplanes painting. Yeah, we also got Trump, and he is definitely in the Epstein files on the list. This is what the realization has come to be for me, and I think a lot of people, is that from Clinton all the way to Trump and Biden, Epstein was president. And that's why we've gotten war after war after war in the Middle East. That's why America has been getting, like, progressively robbed. And that's why we have the surveillance state that we did after 9/11, which Israel is largely in charge of. Any final reflections on January 6th? I'll say this. 30 seconds into the building, I stopped somebody from stealing. I volunteered to help the police. That's why they were escorting me around the building. When I got out of the building, when I heard Donald Trump tell everybody to go home, I stood in front of a violent mob of angry people trying to break into the Capitol, stopped them from breaking in, and told everybody to go home. I played Donald Trump's tweet on my megaphone and literally stopped everybody from trying to break into the Capitol. But none of this was ever really reported in the media at all, because it went against the narrative. So I was probably the calmest and coolest head there all that day, and they tried to destroy me because it fit their narrative. Remember that if you miss any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on On Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the programs you're interested in, and click on Listen. Next, we have a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on January 7th. Carrie Lake may be planning to inflict herself upon a different state. Here's the bad news. Carrie Lake may be eyeing another run at statewide office. Here's the good news. She may be doing it in Iowa. On Wednesday, MS Now reported that Lake recently purchased a $60,000 condo in eastern Iowa. property records show a two-bedroom condominium in Davenport, Iowa, was sold to a family trust controlled by Lake, according to MS Now. The condo, in a brick apartment building, is near where Lake graduated high school and an hour away from where she attended college at the University of Iowa. After two failed election bids in Arizona, for governor and for the Senate, Lake is said to be considering reviving her political career in her home state. That could mean a run for the Senate seat currently held by Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, who has occupied it for 45 years. The 92-year-old Grassley is up for re-election in 2028 and has not said that he's retiring, but he would be 95 on Election Day if he ran again. If the condo is indeed a sign the Lake is jumping ship to another state, she may soon become another state's problem. Though it doesn't feel like it, Lake's time as an Arizona election pest has been relatively short. She worked as a news anchor for Phoenix's Fox 10 for decades before shifting gears in 2021 to run for governor against Democrat Katie Hobbs. Since then, her glossy interviews, election conspiracy theories, and constant Twitter antagonizing have been an ever-present feature of Arizona politics. Branding herself as Trump in heels, Lake's tight relationship with MAGA and President Donald Trump brought her lots of attention nationally, but she failed to connect with voters locally. She narrowly lost to Hobbs in 2022, after which Lake fiercely promoted bullshit theories that the election had been stolen from her. Despite losing court case after court case seeking to overturn the contest, Lake has never abandoned her election denialism. That denialism became so severe that former Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer, a Republican, sued her for defamation over Lake's repeated accusations that he tilted the contest for Hobbs. In 2024, Lake settled that defamation suit with Richer after having accepted a default judgment against her. In 2024, Lake took another shot at statewide office, running against Democratic Senator Ruben Gallego for the state's open Senate seat. Despite appearing on the same ballot as Trump, who comfortably carried the state, Lake lost again, this time by a wider margin. Though she has promoted fewer conspiracy theories about her 2024 loss, she's never formally conceded to Gallego and continues to attack him on social media. Despite speculation that Lake is shifting her focus toward Iowa's politics, it doesn't look like Lake will let Arizona off her hook just yet. On social media, she's still clinging to her Arizona conspiracy theories. Late Tuesday night, Lake took to X to write, "All the top Arizona government roles are fraudulently occupied. Arizona elections are theater. Everyone knows it." Lake did not respond to a request for comment from Phoenix New Times. Arizona is already getting a break from Lake, sort of. At the start of his second administration, Trump announced that Lake would take a role as a special advisor to the U.S. Agency for Global Media. Once there, Lake engineered an en masse firing of employees at Voice of America, a government-led radio broadcast network, resulting in a lawsuit that landed Lake back in her comfort place, court. She's now technically a State Department official. If Lake is turning to Iowa as her next political gambit, it won't be unfamiliar. She held multiple political rallies in Iowa in 2023, at which she continued to promote her conspiracy theories of widespread election fraud. Whether that crap plays any better in Iowa remains to be seen. Here's a story written by T.J. LeHarue and posted on January 7th. Glendale facing lawsuit after cops shot and killed wrong man. One evening in early 2025, Glendale police descended upon Horizon Park near North 47th Avenue and West Butler Drive. They were on the hunt for Angelo Diaz, a 23-year-old domestic violence suspect. Instead, they found and fatally shot 46-year-old Dylan Siebeck, an uninvolved bystander. Sivek's death on January 8, 2025, generated outrage at the time and calls for transparency as the shooting was investigated. Now, his brother and mother, Arliss Sivek and Helen Dohm, are suing the city and two of the cops involved in the shooting for carelessly taking Sivek from them. On New Year's Eve, the pair filed a wrongful death suit in the United States District Court for the state of Arizona. According to the suit, Sivek's relatives now seek some measure of justice on behalf of Mr. Sivek, who was unlawfully and unjustifiably killed by an officer of the Glendale Police Department who was entrusted to protect the public. The suit names the city, Officer James Gonzalez, and his supervisor, Sergeant Joshua Anderkin, as defendants. Glendale spokesperson Jose Santiago said the city would not comment on the lawsuit, but did say the department fired Gonzalez in December after two reviews by a Response to Resistance Board and a Citizens Review Panel. They found the shooting was outside of policy, and keeping him as a public safety officer could potentially be a safety risk to our community. Anderkin remains on the force, Santiago added. The lawsuit also accuses Gonzalez of excessive force and unlawful seizure, faults Anderkin for failure to intervene and supervise, accuses both cops of failure to render aid, and holds the city liable for the city's constitutional violations. The wrongful death of Dylan Sivek is, unfortunately, a textbook example of excessive force violations by police, said attorney Antonio Romanucci of Romanucci & Blandin, which is representing Sivek's family in the case, in a press release. This man was unarmed and did not present any type of threat to the officers. He was not a suspect in a crime and was minding his own business. Dylan's loss of life was completely needless. We will pursue accountability for what happened that evening in Glendale. Romanucci's firm previously called for Glendale police to release all relevant body camera footage of the incident. Sivek did not display any weapon, and he made no verbal or physical threats to any individual, the lawsuit states. Officer Gonzalez had no justification for shooting at Dylan, who posed no threat to any person or property. Officer Gonzalez could not have reasonably perceived that Dylan was a threat to any person or property at the time he fired, as Dylan was hundreds of feet away, was unarmed, was not displaying or in possession of any weapons, and made no physical or verbal threats to any officer or any other person. ABC 15 reported that Sivek, who was from Tucson, was a father and Army veteran who struggled with mental health issues. The station reported that Sivek had been released from an Arizona prison 9 days earlier. Dylan loved to make people laugh and would literally do anything for the people he cared about, said Arliss Sivek in a press release. Our family deeply misses his huge heart, and his death has changed us forever. What upsets us is what happened to Dylan could happen to anyone. It could have been anyone in the park at that time, and unfortunately it was my brother. We sincerely hope that this lawsuit can bring transparency and accountability for his loss, but also can create change for the community so that no family ever has to go through this again. Good man, good man. The tragic chain of events was set off by a hunt for Diaz. Per the suit, cops found a white pickup truck that matched the description of Diaz's vehicle and instructed anyone inside to exit the vehicle with hands raised. When no one answered, the cops noted that there could be someone hiding inside before they inexplicably shifted their attention away from the vehicle to Sivek, who was sitting on a picnic table 100 yards away. The lawsuit notes that Sivek bore little resemblance to the description of the suspect sought by police. Unlike GPD's suspect, Dylan was 46 years old, twice the age of the man they were looking for, the lawsuit says. Unlike GPD's suspect, Dylan was not Hispanic. The suit says Gonzalez pointed an assault rifle at Seebeck, and several other officers pointed their guns toward the man. Using a PA system, Anderkin instructed Angelo to walk toward the officers with his hands up. The suit claims Seebeck complied, prompting Anderkin to say, "Good man, good man." At the time, Glendale police claimed Seebeck made a movement towards his waistband. Though the lawsuit filed by Seebeck's relatives does not directly address that allegation. Dillon was unarmed. Dillon at no point displayed or possessed any weapon. Dillon made no verbal or physical threats to anyone or any property at any time, it states, adding that there was no one else in the vicinity. While Anderkin told Seebeck, whom he again called Angelo, to keep his hands on his head, the suit says, Angelus fired two shots with the assault rifle without giving any warning that he was going to shoot. There was no attempt to use less lethal weapons. After the shots and the instructions, the suit says, there is a 14-second pause in which no further instructions are given by any GPD officer. Gonzalez then fired two more shots, with at least one striking Seebeck, who went down. The suit says he remained on the ground for nearly 20 minutes before any life-saving aid was offered. According to the suit, Anderkin said, "Suspect down," and added that police would need the dog to get this guy. Anderkin allegedly did not order any officers to provide medical care or radio for medics until 15 minutes after Seebeck was shot, a delay that the suit claims Anderkin knew or should have known would mean likely death. It wasn't until 19 minutes after Seebeck was shot that officers approached him, taking 1 minute and 15 seconds to cover the distance between them, the lawsuit claims. Eventually, the officers looked inside Diaz's vehicle and found Diaz dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The Peoria Police Department was tasked with investigating the incident. In a statement to New Times on Tuesday, the department said that in February, it forwarded the case to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, which determined in April that there was no reasonable likelihood of conviction. A history of excessive force. At the time of the shooting, State Senator Annalise Ortiz demanded accountability. Anytime a police officer shoots and kills someone, there needs to be full transparency and a thorough investigation, Ortiz, whose district includes Horizon Park, told New Times last year. In this case, the fact that this person who was shot and killed was not even the person that the police were after is absolutely horrifying. To New Times and in a press release, Ortiz highlighted the larger issue of policing in the Valley and the United States. This pattern of police shooting first and asking questions later is a common pattern that we see, and in this case, it ended up being deadly for an innocent person, Ortiz told New Times. There needs to be accountability and there needs to be answers. My constituents use the park and enjoy the park. Nobody should have to fear that when they're out and about, a police officer is just going to rush up and take their lives. About 2 years before Seebeck was killed, Glendale police shot and killed a 15-year-old, prompting calls for more transparency. Ortiz said a year ago that she was in contact with the boy's family, who faced challenges getting clear answers from the police department, noting that a common factor in police killings is that families are shut out of the process. Ortiz did not immediately respond on Tuesday when New Times asked for comment on the lawsuit. The lawsuit also details Glendale Police's documented pattern and practice of excessive force, naming at least 9 incidents in which Glendale cops used what it claims was unjustified and unnecessarily violent tactics. It also alleges that the city has failed to hold its officers accountable for such behavior. The incidents it lists includes a February 2015 shooting in which an officer shot a man who was raising his hands, a 2016 incident in which an officer fired 15 times and killed a suspect's twin brother, and Officer Matthew Schneider's tasing of Johnny Wheatcroft in the genitals in 2017, for improperly using a turn signal. The lawsuit claims that Schneider had been disciplined by the city of Glendale at least 6 times, yet was permitted to retain his police powers. An April 2019 report noted that the city had paid $3.6 million in settlements during the previous 5 years, though not all were related to police misconduct claims. The city has settled at least 2 other cases since then, including Wheatcross, but the amounts of those settlements were not made public. Trump snubs most MAGA candidate in Arizona congressional primary. This next story was written by TJ LaHiru and posted on January 7th. A second Donald Trump endorsement has hit the Republican primary in Arizona's 1st congressional district, a competitive Northeast Valley seat centered geographically and culturally on Scottsdale. Representative David Schweikert, who is running for governor, currently represents the district. On Tuesday, the president wrote on Truth Social, perhaps unironically, that he was giving his complete and total endorsement to both Gina Swoboda, the Arizona Republican Party chair, whom he endorsed in October, and Jay Feely, a former NFL kicker who played for the Arizona Cardinals for 3 seasons. Jay and Gina have been with us from the very beginning, Trump wrote, and either one would be an incredible representative who would work tirelessly to grow our economy, cut taxes and regulations, promote Made in the USA, champion American energy dominance, keep our now very secure border secure, stop migrant crime, strengthen our military veterans, and defend our always under siege Second Amendment. Trump seems to like making double endorsements in Arizona. 2 years ago, he endorsed both Abe Hamada and Blake Masters in the GOP primary for the 8th Congressional District, which Hamada won. He also endorsed both MAGA lapdog Representative Andy Biggs and wealthy businesswoman Karen Taylor Robeson in this year's GOP race for governor. The CD1 race projects to be one of the most closely contested in Arizona and across the country, with Democrats hoping to flip the seat as Schweikert, who has held office since 2011, sets his sights on the governorship. Swoboda was the first big name to jump into the race, earning Trump's endorsement last year. Feely initially submitted to run for Congress in Congressional District 5, Biggs' current district, but switched it up on Trump's advice after former Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb entered that race. We wish Gilbert resident Jay Feely well in his latest campaign for Congress, but nothing has changed. Gina Swoboda will be the Republican nominee for AZ1. Swoboda campaign consultant Chris Baker told Phoenix New Times in a written statement. Notably absent among the Trump endorsements was the most MAGA candidate in the race, State Representative Joseph Chaplick. Left out. If the announcement was at all sour for both Feely and Swoboda, the lack of invitation to the Cool Kids Club might have been crushing for Chaplick, who is the most far-right candidate in the race and has actually represented part of the district since 2021. Chaplick, a clean-cut real estate investor reminiscent of Patrick Bateman, is a member of the Arizona Freedom Caucus at the state legislature, which is led by far-right state senator Jake Hoffman. Chaplick announced just a few weeks ago that he would also run for the seat Schweikert is abandoning. Since then, he has been doing his darndest to earn his far-right bona fides. In the fall, he became obsessed with retweeting bigoted anti-Muslim content. When New Times reported on the posts in October, Chaplick did not respond to New Times questions about the posts. He did, however, return a call by accident. "Oh, shoot, I think I dialed the wrong number. I'm sorry," he said, adding that his communications advisor, Ross Trumbull, was supposed to be contacting New Times. New Times did not hear from Trumbull by publication. Chaplick did not respond to a call or text from New Times, purposely or accidentally, for this piece. Though Chaplick's politics most closely align with Trump's, If there's logic to be found in the state lawmaker's lack of endorsement, it might have to do with his chances in the district. Trump narrowly won the district in 2024, but Democrat Ruben Gallego carried it in his Senate race against Kerry Lake. Schweikert has held on to his seat by slim margins in each of the last two election cycles, winning by less than a percentage point in 2020. Chaplick might just be too far right to win the seat. The team of at least one other candidate in that primary is pissed off about the double endorsement. John Trobow, a technology CEO, joined the crowded field in November. His campaign strategist, Alfredo Rodriguez, ripped into Trump, albeit obsequiously. It is sad to see that our great president has made the decision to hand out participation ribbons in the most competitive open congressional seat in the country, Rodriguez said in a written statement provided to New Times. John Trobow is not deterred and more determined than ever to win. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for other interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.